You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of June 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of Midori House, coming to you live from London as Britain votes to leave the European Union.
If Parliament judges that a second referendum is the best or only way to protect our place in Europe, it must have the option to hold one within that timescale.
That Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon: could a fractured European Union lead to a fractured United Kingdom? Plus, Boris Johnson and David Cameron might be in no rush to leave just yet, but the European Commission President is already pointing Britain towards the exit.
We now expect the United Kingdom government to give effect to this decision of the British people as soon as possible, however painful that process may be.
Jean-Claude Juncker there. That's all to come on Midori House, live from London with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are all Monocle editors, Tom Edwards, our executive producer, and Andrew Tuck, our editor. Andrew, bit of a day.
Well, I'm going to try and speak in at least a perky voice, but I must say that there's a real kind of feeling of depression, I think, in the building, that many of the things that we're very, very passionate about have been undone in one foul swoop. You know, this is a magazine that for the last 10 years has said to people, you know, get off your backsides, go around the world, find places to settle, start new businesses, meet different people. Don't feel that you're tied down by your nationality just doing one thing. You know, and the amazing thing is, you know, whether I was going to do it or not, you know, I knew always that if I fancied it, I could get up tomorrow, move to Berlin, open a company, employ people, and there was no one who could stop me. That was my right. I could do that within Europe. I had an access to a world of opportunity and excitement and culture that was truly, truly exciting. And we're about to lose all that. We're going to get to the stage where people have to apply for visas and permission to go and live places. You know, we've got a generation of kids who can get on a train, go to Paris and study. They don't have to ask permission. They can just go and do it. They can go and learn French. They can take a job there for the summer. They don't have to ask permission. And now suddenly, whether you're, you know, a teenager, you know, somebody in midlife who fancies a bit of a life change, or you're working in banking, that is going to change. Whether we like it or not, that is going to change. And that world of opportunity and ambition, I think it's stealing it from a generation. And those are the things that people haven't thought about. All those things are going to hit home. And lastly, you know, when I look at the people in our office, you know, we've got people here from, you know, Italy, from Portugal, you know, who came to the UK because they wanted to do better for themselves. They wanted careers. And speaking to them today, you know, that feeling of, you know, what does this mean? You know, there's no guarantee what we're going to do for these people. There's an air of uncertainty. And there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people in London and across the UK who are here doing amazing jobs, doing incredible things. And we've put a question mark next to every single one of them. And we've made every single one of them think, you know, they're not quite welcome. And I think, you know, that, you know, I'm kind of angry about it. I feel this is not in my name. And I don't, we'll talk about a little bit more about the notion of who voted in and voted out. But this is not in my name.
Tom, when you look at the breakdown of the votes, there's, you know, the biggest votes for Remain were in London. It was in Manchester. It was in Edinburgh. It was in our most cosmopolitan cities. The cities where there are opportunities, and also the cities where there are more migrants than others.
Yeah, Steve, I mean, this is exactly what I was going to say. I've been trying to strike a relentlessly upbeat note today, but I have to say, Andrew, that has made me feel rather depressed, and I think quite rightly, because there's something, I don't know if it's right to be ashamed of, because we've been complicit in the sense that we all played our part in the vote and we weren't able to get a Remain vote, but I don't know if we should take personal responsibility. It's hard not to. I was going to say, in answer to that though, Andrew, you strike that note about, you know, a generation robbed of opportunity, and what I find increasingly and it dawned on me particularly while Andrew was speaking, frustrating about this, is that the waiting, Steve, I'll come on to the cities in a minute, but it's the age perspectives.
Yeah.
You know, huge wait in the 65 pluses to leave. Now, these arguments that are being made by many of those people are about immigration. They're certainly about opportunity and things like that. Well, if you're 65 plus, I know there's a few active members of society, but many are kind of winding down. And it does feel like an opportunity robbed. And we've talked before about baby boomer generation kind of, you know, escaping and sort of cutting the ropes for those that want to follow. And it does feel like that. The only thing I would say, Andrew, and I will attempt to strike another relentlessly optimistic note, is the kind of people you described, hungry, international, interested in other people, confident in their own abilities to shape the world positively, I still believe those people will seek out opportunities, and they maybe even can seek out a way to reverse this if it needs to be reversed. Okay, it's not going to happen quickly, but who knows, maybe 10 years from now, if this is as bad, if this is as bad,
it's never being reversed, if it's
as damaging as some fear, there could be an opportunity down the road, especially if this younger generation maybe get fed up with what's happening.
We have half the country who don't want freedom of movement. No, it will not be reversed.
They're not going to be around forever, Andrew. I don't want to, that's a crude point, but what about when this younger generation, the under 35s, are running everything?
But, you know, the notion, so let's remember, actually half the country, a bar, you know, of 500,000 here and there, want to remain in Europe. So, you know, this isn't a kind of a unified shift. Yes, at this moment in time, in this week, it turned out that more people voted for leave. Now, on the other side, there are 16 million people who voted to stay. Now, they're all being described as, you know, lily-livered, liberal, you know, London elites. They're not. They're people all across the country. But, you know, and I don't want to tarnish or, you know, try and make caricatures of one side or the other too simplistically, but the people in the end who decided to remain are, if they're a kind of an annoying liberal elite, I'm kind of proud to be one of them. They're a group of people who don't have problems with difference, who manage to adapt to other cultures, who see opportunity in diversity. Those are all things which I think are British, and I think that it should have been championed as British. And, you know, if that is an elite, and if that is kind of out of touch with the other people, well, I'm sorry, then I think there's still something to be said for that.
Let me bring in Tyler Brulé, our editor-in-chief, who joined us on the line. I believe we've spoken to you in Hamburg, we've spoken to you in Denmark during the day. You've been on a bit of a European tour. Tyler, where are you right now?
I'm on the shores of the Øresund, Steve. Looking back to Denmark, I'm on the Swedish side now. So it has well and truly been a test of borders, some unchecked, some also with controls on them as well. And one of the striking things since we were chatting at midday was I was coming off a ferry, which goes from Helsingør to Helsingborg. It's a very, very quick 20-minute journey. But on both sides, there are checks now. There are Danish checks before you get on. There's also Swedish customs at the other side. It was quite interesting. There was a gentleman who was obviously a contractor for one of the security companies, a Gurkha, and he looked at my passport, and just without even skipping a beat, he just said, "I'm really sorry for what happened today." He said, "He goes, I trust you are on the side of Remain." I said, "Yes." And he said, "It's horrible." He said, "When people are duped and ill informed and make those types of decisions," and you know, off he went and off we went. But I thought it was a very curious departure from Denmark and welcome to Sweden.
Tyler, I don't know if you picked up Andrew's point just before you came on, but he was talking about how, look, let's not forget that this was a split almost down the middle, and that there is, you know, a large population within the UK that does accept freedom of movement, that isn't anti-immigrant in the way that it's clear that certainly a certain number on the Leave side are. Do you think that a better case needs to be made by people like that, people like us, about what freedom of movement, what diversity can do for a nation?
Absolutely. Just education alone. You know, already I was talking to some Swedish people as well, and I said, what does this look like? What does this mean if you are 15 in the UK, or you're 25 in the UK, that, you know, if we're looking sort of 3 or 4 years out, depending on, of course, what type of ball game the EU wants to play, legislators in Brussels and elsewhere, you could be looking at a generation of people who simply do not have the opportunity to get easily transferred, or not even transferred, just to say, I'm going to just up sticks. I want to live in Warsaw for 3 years, or go down to Lisbon. And that is just remarkable. And this goes back to, I think, you know, a bit of a running theme, but these were the selling points that were not talked up. And I firmly believe that this still needs airtime. We've obviously seen how Scotland has voted, Northern Ireland, and certainly within, of course, the confines of London. And I think, you know, certainly I'm not sure what the discussion is in London this evening, but just, you know, we can talk about the region, Steve, and of course manufacturing, and we can see why people might be disgruntled in Wales, etc. But we also have to, there's a reality check about, you know, where is the economic engine of the country, and it is lying in London.
Andrew, just on the point you were talking about before, in terms of, you know, London has been a city which has attracted young people from all over Europe, as this is a place where, whether it's to come here to study, whether it's to come here to work for a, you know, a year in a pret-a-manger or a coffee place, or whether it's just a place to come and be here and see what happens and do what you want. Is there anywhere that you see across Europe which could become, is in a sense, the new London? Because there is something particular about this city that has attracted people, isn't it?
Oh, I'm not decrying the city. I think this city is an amazing, amazing place. And I think, you know, that people will still want to come here. And of course, at a certain level, people will still be allowed to come here. But in that sense that they're going to try and stop everybody who isn't highly skilled coming here, well, that's crazy. You know, we need people actually to run our restaurants, to clean our blooming old people's homes, you know, and those jobs go to migrants. So, you know, I think all of that is amazing. But yeah, when you look across the European landscape, we know that Berlin is affordable and most people in Berlin speak good English and good German and are kind of welcoming. We know that somewhere like Lisbon, you can get good opportunities. Paris, well, as already is luring as we speak the financial companies to come across, because that is, you know, again, one of the horrible frameworks of this debate has been, do not trust business. Do not trust anyone who works in the financial sector. Do not trust anyone who has a skill. Do not trust anyone who is successful, because they are part of some crazy elite that have a conspiracy against the ordinary man. Well, unfortunately, it's the people who run those businesses that often employ the ordinary man. And actually, many of the ordinary men and women who voted yesterday, actually, they did decide in the end to remain. So I think, yes, there are other places that can do well, but I think the whole prism that around the UK debate, which is, you know, bashing business all the time, I think it's just going to help every other city in Europe.
Tom, I want to come on to this thing that Andrew raises there or touches on, which is this sense that we're living in a slightly sort of post-fact world, that actually it didn't matter what the facts said. This was, you know, Michael Gove, you know, the Lisa Leave campaign, now famously said, you know, I think we've heard enough from experts. What does that tell us about where we are, not just as a nation, but this is something that we're seeing in the US with Donald Trump. It's something that we've seen obviously pumped out by Russia. And, you know, you expect that in some sense from, you know, Kremlin TV. But we're seeing this now in the West, the fact that people don't trust experts. They don't trust so-called elites.
I think you can stomach if a sort of a despot or a regime that controls the media or seeks to pumps out bilge of an anti-intellectualist nature. You're not going to like it, but you can understand where it comes from and what its objective is. The really depressing thing, and I think the thing that's certainly as worrying about what's happened to London in the last sort of 48 hours is that, you know, it speaks to this absolute failure of our political system, our political parties, our politicians, to break what seems to be a shift to the right, and a shift towards, you know, populism and definitely anti-intellectualism. You've got Donald Trump, who couldn't have embodied this any better than by touching down in Scotland and saying the place is going crazy. They've taken the control of their country back. Beyond even willful misunderstanding of the situation. And we're seeing this trend, as you say, Steve, on both sides of the Atlantic and across Europe. And that is genuinely well, it's incredibly worrying.
Tyler, if I can bring you in on this point, where do we go from here with this sort of, in this sort of post-truth world? Is it down to political leadership? Is it down to responsible journalism? Where do we go?
I think we have an enormous role to play. And even this morning, I was wondering, did it take us a bit too long to perhaps hang out our flag? I mean, one would hope that certainly our own readership, it would go almost unspoken that they know where we would stand on this issue. But you know, maybe there was a role and a part to be played on many other titles. And I think also it was interesting, 2 weeks ago, when we saw Der Spiegel bring out that cover, that Please Don't Go. I think there was another element that was missing in all of this, and that is one out of Brussels. And I thought that there could have been a bit more of a PR campaign that also could have been done as to the reason to believe, Steve. And you raised the point earlier, the fact that just there was no catchy slogan for Remain. Well, that's one part of it. But I also think that Brussels and maybe some other nations had a role to play in it, but who knows? I mean, did we all get really just lulled into the sense that it was all going to be all right? It was going to be close, but it was going to be at this 52-53% in favor of Remain. So the marketing firms, the great marketeers, were not mobilized, and maybe at the same time, the journalists and the editors at Europe's most important outlets, also didn't get out of their chairs fast enough.
Andrew, when we look at what happens next, we've been talking about London, how it's been 60-40 in favour of remaining. We've had Sadiq Khan has today come out and said, with a message to the almost 1 million people from the EU who live in London now, that we need you, we want you, we essentially cherish you. Do you think that will be enough to help bring this city around? Or do you think we're actually going to struggle in the years ahead?
Collectively in London, we're like people on the way home who tripped up on the pavement, banged their head. I think we're all a bit dazed and spinning around today. That will settle down. And let's remember, it's going to be 2 to 3 years as we negotiate our way out of the EU. And I've got a feeling that many of the things that we think are going to rapidly change, when it comes to it, if they want to be part of a single market, if they want to do well in Europe, they're going to have to give up quite a lot of these things that they think they're going to kind of strike out. I think that some of the things around the European court, etc., will undoubtedly change. But I wouldn't be surprised if actually they're forced by circumstance to leave in place, hopefully, and I hope they are, a great deal about the freedom of movement of young people, of entrepreneurs, of students. And I hope that definitely happens. But just on this notion of the experts, I guess there are two reasons I feel downhearted today. One is the cultural thing. I kind of like feeling a bit European, and I don't feel any kind of antipathy towards my Britishness. I just like feeling a bit European. I like crossing borders. I go in places, and I feel I have much in common with the people I meet. But the other thing is on this expert side. If you want to kind of cheer yourself up tonight, do not read what Bloomberg has to say, what The Economist has to say, what the FT has to say, what the New York Times has to say. There is not one of those key media outlets who've called on experts and professors and economists that has a trajectory that looks positive for the next 4 or 5 years. It's a group of people who've voted yesterday who have determinedly said that they are happy for the economy to flounder in order to address what they see as a cultural problem, which is migration.
Andrew, I just want to say then, what do you do in absence of that media? Is it looking for a very good bottle of something nice in the Douro Valley?
Well, we know what mobile people will do. We know that for a few hundred thousand euros, you can invest in Portugal and you get a Portuguese passport. It's already been on several sites today saying it's one of the most searched for terms today is, how do I get an Irish passport? How do I get a Portuguese passport? How do I get a Canadian passport? People who are mobile are going to feel challenged about it. I think you're right there, Tyler. For us as a media brand, and and I'll admit, I'm disheartened, cross, dismay today. But, you know, I will come back and so will this media brand, because in the end, you know, we know that the narration that we've given over the last 10 years is one of positivity. It's one of opportunity and getting around hurdles. And we will find ways around that, because there are a group of people here in the UK and around the world who are creative and connected and want to work together and who will not let this stop them.
I'm going to leave you, gentlemen, on that note, and I'll turn it back to you, because I'm not sure about Swedish wines, but there are some very nice beverages that were bought somewhere else on the continent without duties or anything applied to them. I'm going to go and enjoy those.
Okay, you drown your sorrows.
We'll look forward to reconvening next week.
Thanks, Tyler.
Cheers, Tyler.
Let's look at the political situation here in the UK. This is something we're going to explore in a little more detail on tomorrow's Foreign Desk, about sort of how united the United Kingdom may now be. We've heard from Nicola Sturgeon, the First Minister of Scotland, saying Scotland has voted to stay within the European Union and that should be respected. And if it's not by the rest of the UK, then maybe it's time we had another referendum. We are talking seriously about the potential breakup of the UK, aren't we?
Yeah, well, absolutely. And I think it's interesting. I mean, I know, Andrew, you said you didn't want to sort of point the finger at one group or another, but culpable here to a marked degree, in my view, is the Conservative and Unionist Party. I know I think they dressed that bit out of their name, but it's worth pointing that out. A schism in that party over this has for 20 years, 30 years even, been like the defining issue for them. No one really knows why. Many other people haven't cared, and we've got on with it and fashioned a good place for ourselves in the world. It was Cameron's bid to try and solve that, or trying to appease the right against the left, that we called this referendum in the first place. And he's brought his own administration to an end. He's damned by history now, which he can't be too happy about. And yeah, as well as hastening the British departure from the UK, he could, unwittingly or wittingly, I don't know, have gone a long way towards challenging the very, you know, enduring status of the Union. And I think we shouldn't be shy about, you know, pointing out the fact that the Conservative Party has a significant case to answer on this.
And I think when you look at the, you know, this is the other, you know, it is that I think it's probably the first time in, you know, in decades when I have looked at the political lineup and cannot spot a single person who I think I would like to be the leader of the UK, or who I think would be a successful leader of the UK. I look at, you know, look, the left is led by a very clever intellectual lefty who appeals to other clever intellectual lefties and a few trade unionists. He has no appeal beyond that and has no chance in hell of ever being prime minister, but will cling on until there's an election and he's booted out. And now we have a Tory party that is moving to the right. And we know that British politics doesn't like realignments, but it has left this vacuum where, you know, Cameron has sat, where the Blairites sat, where there was this middle ground, which, you know, you look back now to the days of Blair, you know, we know he messed up many things around Iraq, and let's not get into that, but here were a group of politicians who wanted to occupy the centre ground, and all of those people have been dispersed now by this terrible, terrible event.
And of course, Tom, there is one other politician we haven't mentioned so far in today's programme, who will be incredibly happy, and that's Nigel Farage, leader of the UK Independence Party, who I heard one Tory politician this morning saying, well, maybe UKIP will disband because they've achieved their goal now.
Funnily enough, I agree with him, because you kind of hope that having secured this success...
But it's not going to happen. They are now the anti-establishment
party. We don't know.
Party.
I mean, all I would say about that is he's not an MP. They have only got one MP.
Yeah, but they got 4 million votes the last election.
Well,
they've helped to win this referendum.
They haven't been able to galvanise that into an effective political movement until this moment, and we don't know what they might seek to do. What worries me is, I agree with you, Andrew, I can't see a politician that I can see being, you know, a unity candidate reclaiming that centre ground, but I can't even see in the makeup and the constitution and the attitude of either of the two parties who are kind of left duking this out, the Tories and Labour, any prospect of that happening in the next few years. Where's the politician who's going to articulate the kind of attitude that you spoke about, that's positive, that's ambitious, that's hungry to go out into the world with a positive message? I can't see that coming out at all. So are we looking at a complete, breakup of the existing political party framework to try and find somebody who can articulate that.
And Andrew, there's a broader underlying problem here, isn't there, which is that there are big problems in Britain, as we well know, but immigration and European Union membership were not necessarily those big problems. There's poverty, there's wealth disparity, and you know, you look at the areas which voted to leave and they were overwhelmingly poor.
Look, you know, I think on the migration question, I'm probably somebody who does have some questions about it. I don't think it's a bad idea that you can control your borders and know how many people are coming in and out. I don't think that means, you know, having like border checks and giant passport stamps on everyone's passport. I think it's fine to know how people are moving. It allows you to plan social services. It allows you to know how people are coming to go to your doctor's surgery or go to a school. I understand that. And I understand that many of these people end up in poorer communities where there is already a sense of a loss of identity, especially in kind of post-industrial towns. So, I, in fact...
Sorry, I didn't mean to dismiss it like that. I was saying if migration is only 200,000,
only 200,000 a year, but I do think it is a big issue. And again, let's blame Juncker, let's blame Merkel, because, you know, if they had said a year ago when Cameron was starting this negotiation process, actually, we're not that cool on it and we understand it, but there is potentially a way here for you to kind of step aside and be a bit more of an associate member, and we would let you have a little bit more control over your migration. Then something could have happened. Or there were many things, even in the last 2 weeks, when they could see how tight it was, they could have said, look, have the vote, and once you've had the vote, we promise we will look at this issue because we understand the pressure on your social services, and more important, the pressure on the sense of identity of your people, and we will engage with that. But instead, they were dismissive. You know, there's a real sense from Europe that anybody who questions migration is, you know, an idiot or, you know, so far on the right to be questionable. I'm not of that view. I think you can question it, but on the whole, when it comes down to it, is it good for the economy? Yes. Why has Britain done so well over the past few years? It's because people have come here, set up companies, made money, paid their taxes, and run our services.
Tom, when we look to the rest of Europe, and it's something we've touched on, you know, throughout the day about what might happen next with France, what might happen next with the Netherlands, what might happen next, just full stop, with the European Union. It's hard to feel hopeful, whether you are a supporter of the European Union or not. It's, you know, there's a choice between stability and instability. And as Andrew points out, you know, these are, you know, bureaucratic organisations that are not good at change, they're not good at accepting when things aren't working. There's not a lot of, I know you've been trying to be very optimistic throughout the day, but when you look at the European Union project, it's hard to be hopeful, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, again, to try and cling on to something, perhaps this, and it's paradoxical that Britain's departure could hasten this, is this the wake-up call, a last chance to address some of the complacency that Andrew just described for, you know, some of the key EU figures, whether we look to Berlin or look to Paris, to address some of the failings and to look at structural changes, significant reforms that may address some of those, for example, in this country, maybe in the slightly more middle ground, who were pushed into the leave position. The paradox being, of course, Britain's gone. It's too late for us. But maybe that will be enough to prevent, is it the Dutch or whoever who might come next saying, well, hang on, what about our referendum? I sincerely hope so, because otherwise I do see an unravelling and a continuation of this seemingly inexorable shift towards populist rhetoric and towards the right.
Okay. I thought we'd end on a hopeful note, but we sort of did.
Well, no, let's be hopeful, but in the sense that, you know, in the end, you know, if this is the wrong decision, British people will find, we won't get back into the EU, but we will find a way of making it work. Mm. And I think the other positive thing is that we know the people around this table, our friends, our colleagues in London, the wider community in London, and in many other towns and cities around this country, do not want this narrative and will do their best to circumnavigate it.
Andrew Tuck, Tom Edwards, and earlier Tyler Brulé, thank you all very much indeed. That's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. On the day that Britain voted to leave the European Union, we'll have more analysis, more news on this later on tonight on the Monocle Daily. That's 2200 here in London. Also tune in to the Foreign Desk tomorrow at 12 noon when we're discussing what the European Union vote means for the United Kingdom. My guests are Peter Hain, Ming Campbell, and Malcolm Rifkind. My name is Steve Bloomfield. That was Midori House. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.